just to help us remember where we're at, this is the second round of speeches by Job's friends. The second round started in chapter 15 with Eliphaz, and then we read Job's response to that in chapter 16 and 17. And then Bildad chimes in again in chapter 18. I think I told you last week I dubbed him Impatient Bildad because both times so far that he's started his speech, he started with something along the lines of, "Will you just please be quiet, Job? Stop talking for a second." He says back in chapter 8 during his first speech in verse 2, he says, "How long will you speak these things and the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" And then here in chapter 18, he starts it off very similarly. In verse 2, he says, "How long till you put an end to words?" And then he says, "Gain understanding, and afterward we will speak." Then he asks, "Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rock be removed from its place?" Down to verse 4. When he says, "Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid or without wisdom in your sight?" He's referring back to chapter 16 in verses 10 and 11, where Job is using pretty strong language to complain about the situation that he feels like God has put him in. And in verse 10, he says, "They gape at me with their mouth," talking about his friends. "They strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me. God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of the wicked." So Bildad is kind of rebuking him for talking about them like that. And then in verse 4, where he says, "You who tear yourself in anger," that's an important phrase because in chapter 16, verse 9, Job says, talking about God, "He tears me in his wrath and hates me and gnashes at me with his teeth." And Bildad is essentially saying, "No, God's not tearing you out, Job. You're tearing yourself in anger." And then that, "Shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rock be removed?" The idea there is you know, Job, are you so special that the natural order should be flipped upside down and God should just come and answer you? And though you're wicked, from Bildad's perspective, remember, you have prosperity. In verse 5, he says, "The light of the wicked indeed goes out, and the flame of his fire does not shine. The light is dark in his tent, and his lamp beside him is put out." If you remember, last week we talked about how we are in these second speeches, each by each of the three friends, we're hearing their discourses on what they're calling the wicked man, right? And they're just beating around the bush, really. They mean Job. And the things that they describe about the wicked man indicate that they are talking about Job. They enumerate the things that Job has experienced and is experiencing. So we'll see that in Bildad's discourse on the wicked man too. But remember, he's talking about how he's thinking about Job in this situation. So he verse 5 and 6, he doesn't have light. And verse 7, "The steps of his strength are shortened, and his own counsel casts him down, for he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walks into a snare. The net takes him by the heel, and a snare lays hold of him. A noose is hidden for him on the ground, and a trap for him in the road." The idea there from verse 7 to verse 10 is Bildad saying that the wicked man, Job, essentially, has been ensnared by his own counsel. And you'll see that through each of these three discourses on the wicked. Eliphaz from last week, Bildad from this week, and I think we'll get through Zophar's too tonight. You'll see that they attribute the fault in the situation to Job. They're essentially saying, the reason you're suffering, it's your fault. It's because you are sinful. It's because you're wicked. It's because you have been cast into a net by your own feet, like in verse 8. Verse 11, Bildad says, "Terrors frighten him on every side and drive him to his feet. His strength is starved and destruction is ready at his side. It devours patches of his skin The firstborn of death devours his limbs. That's one of the ones that is very blatantly about Job, right? Back in chapter 2 and verse 7, he developed boils, painful boils on his skin, so that he had to scrape himself with pottery shards, remember? And then most commentators think that the firstborn of death devouring his limbs is Bildad's description of whatever disease might have befallen Job to have those painful boils. In verse 14, he is uprooted from the shelter of his tent. They parade him before the king of terrors. They dwell in his tent, who are none of his. Brimstone is scattered on his dwelling. His roots are dried out below, and his branch withers above. The memory of him perishes from the earth, and he has no name among the renowned. There's another point where it's blatantly about Job. Remember back in chapter 1 and verse 3, it says that he was the greatest of all the people of the East, right? And then in the last chapter in 17, Job himself says, he has made me a byword of the people. So he's gone from the greatest of the people of the East to a byword of the people in standing. He has no renown. In verse 18, he is driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. That's some pretty interesting language, isn't it? To be chased out of the world. Verse 19, he has neither son nor posterity among his people. You can look at chapter 1, Job lost his children, nor any remaining in his dwellings. Those in the west are astonished at his day, as those in the east are frightened. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him who does not know God. So remember, Bildad is saying, essentially, surely such is Job's dwelling, and this is the place of him who does not know God. He accuses Job of not knowing God. And that's not accurate. If you remember back at the beginning of the book, Job was making sacrifices just in case his children sinned. I mean, he was pious down to the very root of the word. And so Bildad is certainly misapplying these things to Job's case. So then we get into chapter 19, where Job responds to Bildad. And he says, "How long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words?" Depending on your translation, it might say, "How long will you crush me with words?" He says in verse 3, "These 10 times you have reproached me." If you remember, when we studied through Revelation, we learned how numbers can be symbolic. Okay, his friends so far have only reproached him 5 times, literally speaking. But 10 is symbolic of the completeness of it, the fullness of it. So he's saying, this whole time you've been reproaching me. And you are not ashamed, the second half of verse 3, that you have wronged me. And if indeed I have erred, verse 4, my error remains with me. So he's essentially saying, if I actually did sin, it's my sin. And that's for me and God to take care of. But he says in verse 5, "If indeed you exalt yourselves against me and plead my disgrace against me, know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net." So he's essentially accusing them of not really understanding the situation, which he's right about. In verse 7, Job says, "If I cry out concerning wrong, I am not heard. If I cry aloud, there is no justice." And then he launches into kind of a reiteration of what he said in chapter 16, starting off in verse 9 and going through like verse 14. He had used really strong language talking about how he felt like God was his adversary, and was treating him like he had hostility toward him. He says in verse 12, "He has taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces, set me up for his target," right? So he gets back into that idea here. And he says in verse 8, "He has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my paths." Without getting too much into God's response in chapter 38, because I want to save most of that as much as I can for when we actually go through it in depth. But I'll give you a little sneak peek at how sophisticated God's response is. He says in verse 8 of chapter 38, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb, when I made the clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band?" So Job expresses, right, that he feels like he's been fenced up. He's been bound. He has darkness in his paths. And I think what God's point is by saying, "I set the boundaries for the sea," I think he's saying that when I set boundaries, it's for a purpose. And when I fence things in, it's for your good. And so Job learns that through the process of God's response. So there's a little hint at that as we get in further to the book. It says in verse 9, "He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. My hope he has uprooted like a tree. He has also kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as one of his enemies. His troops come together and build up their road against me. They encamp all around my tent." So you can see he's talking there as if God is an even like a militaristic enemy toward him, someone who's opposing him, who's hostile toward him. It says in verse 13, "He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my close friends have forgotten me." Job feels abandoned, and rightfully so, I think. As far as the movement that he went through from high status and culture, you remember Eliphaz at the beginning of his first speech talked about how Job's words had strengthened others, how people had gone to him for advice, for help, that kind of thing. And to be reduced to somebody who had to sit outside the community because of his condition in an ash heap, in sackcloth. So he feels completely alone. He's estranged from his family. He says in verse 15, "Those who dwell in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. I call my servant, but he gives no answer. I beg him with my mouth." Then he says in verse 17, "My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am repulsive to the children of my own body. Even young children despise me. I arise and they speak against me. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth." So keep in mind that as Job is talking through these things that he's going through, right, feeling estranged from those who are supposed to be close to him and rely on him, his breath being offensive to his wife, young children despising him, feeling abandoned in that way, his close friends abhor him and have turned against him, right? All those things he's attributing to God because he feels like God is hostile toward him in the moment. So bear that in mind, that's his mindset right now. He sees God as hostile, and he's trying to figure out why that would be. In verse 21, Job hits probably one of the lowest points in all of his book. So throughout the book so far, right, even from the very beginning, Job, whenever he starts talking about deploring his birth, right, he curses the day that he was born and the night that he was conceived in chapter 3, and he asks all those why questions. Why did I not die at birth? Why is light given to him who is in misery? Right, those things. Even then, he doesn't just outright ask for sympathy. But then his friends assume his guilt and wear him down to the point that he gets to in verse 21, where he says, "Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you, my friends. For the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh. So he just outright begs for mercy at this point, begs for pity. He wants them to be his comforters, right? Remember back in just a couple chapters ago, chapter 16, verse 2, miserable comforters are you all, he calls them. But that's what he really desires from them is that comfort. And they just continue to accuse. And the accusations get more brutal as we go further into the book. Zophar, and then Eliphaz's third speech, really where they start to dig into him. But Job's low point is followed up quickly by one of his better statements of resolve. So he says in verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever." I would argue he got better than that. Actually, they're in the Bible. They're not written in a book. They're written in the book, right? It's better than engraved on a rock. But this is his statement in verse 25. "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. How my heart yearns within me." So in all of the terrible suffering that Job is going through, right, there was his statement, "Though he slay me, yet I will trust him." I'd say that's one of the powerful thoughts to keep in mind in our suffering. And then also here, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And even after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God." That's an awesome statement to make. And if you remember back when we talked about how the presence of a mediator is different for us than it was for Job, well, this is different for us too. We have, I think, more information and a better assurance of our hope. If you look in Romans chapter 8, and in verse 18, Paul writes, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." So Paul is essentially saying, whatever we go through now, it's minuscule compared to the glory that we receive if we endure all of that for the name of Christ. It says, "For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. The creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of the body. For we were saved in this hope. Hope that is not seen is not, or hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance." So that's the resolve that Job is showing. He's essentially saying, "I'm suffering through all of these awful things. My friends aren't giving me any sympathy. I'm begging for pity from people who are accusing me of being sinful and accusing me of being at fault and the cause of my own suffering. But even through all of that, he has this hope that he's holding on to with perseverance, right? That his question will be answered. He'll be vindicated, and he knows his Redeemer lives and he'll have the opportunity to stand before him. And we have that opportunity, but we know that we can be made whole in Christ and be blameless to stand before him. And that's a powerful thing to hope for. And then in verse 28 and 29, Job issues another one of the challenges to his friends. He sometimes will end his speech with just a quick little gotcha thing to his ridiculers here, right? So he says in verse 28, "If you should say, 'How shall we persecute him, since the root of the matter is found in me?' Be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword. that you may know that there is a judgment. I'm going to read that out of another translation, and depending on your translation, it'll read a little differently, but it's the same idea. So in verse 28, it says, if you say, how shall we persecute him, and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment. So Job is challenging his friends and saying, if you say, we're going to persecute him and ridicule him and accuse him because we believe that he is the cause of his own suffering, that the root of the matter is found in his sin, then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword. So he says, if you're going to make that accusation, you better be prepared because there's a judgment for that. Do we have any comments or questions through chapters 18 and 19? All right. Then we will get into chapter 20. So this is where Zophar chimes in again, and most commentators believe that he's responding, at least in the first couple verses, directly to what Job just said. So Job says, if you think the root of the matter is in me, that it's the cause of my suffering is my sin, be afraid of the sword for yourselves, right? So Zophar says, therefore my anxious thoughts make me answer because of the turmoil within me. I've heard the rebuke that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. Well, I heard that, Job, and I have to say something about it. In verse 4, he says, do you not know this of old, since man was placed on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? So, Zophar is responding to something Job said in chapter 12. He says in Job said in chapter 12, verse 6, the tents of robbers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure in what God provides by his hand. So, if you remember, I drew on the board, you can still kind of see the lines if you look closely, because they didn't erase very well. There's the correlation versus causation thing that his friends think is happening. So they say, the wicked suffer, Job is suffering, so he must be wicked. Job says there in chapter 12, verse 6, well, the wicked don't always suffer. The wicked are sometimes prosperous, even in their wickedness. And so Zophar is coming back and saying, well, they might prosper very briefly, but they will get what's coming to them. And remember, all these discourses on the wicked that we're hearing, they're indirectly talking about Job and Job's situation. So Zophar says, the wicked will prosper for a minute, but there will be a severe judgment. So essentially he's saying, Job, you prospered for a minute, but there was eventually that severe judgment because you're wicked. So he says in verse 6, though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens and his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuse. So, right, he's prospering, yet he will perish forever. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? So he'll be so utterly judged and destroyed that he'll be gone, is the idea behind that. In verse 8, he will fly away like a dream and not be found. Yes, he will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place behold him any more. His children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will restore his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. So that's essentially the beginning of Zophar's speech, right, on the wicked man. And he's essentially applying that to Job. Job, you had it good for a little bit, but your arrogance, your wickedness, whatever it was that was sinful, brought on this awful judgment that's happening now. That's what happens to the wicked, is what Zophar says. So then, in verse 12, he uses more descriptive language to say essentially the same thing. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he spares it or rations it, and does not forsake it or waste it, but still keeps it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach turns sour. It becomes cobra venom within him. Essentially, the wickedness is sweet for a moment. That's that short prosperity, but it turns sour in the stomach. It causes nausea. Verse 15, he swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God casts them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras. The viper's tongue will slay him. Verse 17, he will not see the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. He will restore that for which he labored and will not swallow it down. For the proceeds from the proceeds of business, he will get no enjoyment. For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has violently seized a house which he did not build. Again, Zophar is applying to Job. None of these things are actually applicable to Job. It just shows that in order to try and prove the point that they're trying to make, Job's friends get further and further and further and further away from the actual truth of the situation, instead of trying to discern and listen and understand. Got ahead of my slides again. So then, in verse 20, because he knows no quietness in his heart, he will not save anything he desires. Nothing is left for him to eat, therefore his well-being will not last. In his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come against him. There in verse 22, that in his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Zophar is essentially saying that Job was arrogantly thinking that he had built everything that he had. But we see that that's not the case. Job was worshiping on a regular basis. He was giving thanks for the things that he had. He was cherishing the things that he had. He was using them for godly purposes and teaching his children to follow after godly purposes and sacrificing for them and the whole nine yards, right? Job was aware of where his blessings came from. He wasn't some kind of arrogant, self-sufficient person. Verse 23, when he is about to fill his stomach, God will cast on him the fury of his wrath and will rain it on him while he is eating. He will flee from the iron weapon. A bronze bow will pierce him through. It is drawn and comes out of the body. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall. Terrors come upon him. In verse 26, total darkness is reserved for his treasures. An unfanned fire will consume him. It shall go ill with him who is left in his tent. And then in verse 27 through 29, Zophar kind of punctuates what he's saying about Job. So he says, the heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. If you remember, Job in previous speeches had said things like, I know that I will be vindicated, and my evidence is on high, right? Zophar says, the heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, and his goods will flow away in the day of his wrath. This is the portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God. So Zophar is essentially saying this is the portion from God for Job because of his wickedness.
I think Zophar might be jealous.
Sounds a little bit like it.
I think Zophar might be just a little bitter because his friend was very successful. And I'm wondering if he's just kind of rubbing it in. It's all wasted away.
Yeah.
I don't know. Zophar seems awfully bitter.
I think it's a combination of that, and also he's talking out of the bitterness of having kind of a stinging rebuke of being unwise and unhelpful.
Nathan? But I think we can see this even in biblical debates and things like that. They get nasty after a while because people get defensive. Their arguments are always, I'm right, this person's wrong, the other guy's wrong, I'm right, this person's wrong, and here's why. And they go through their logical arguments, and when they don't agree, then it gets even worse and worse. It seems like that's kind of the way the arguments are going back and forth between Job and his friends, is that Job points something out, and they are saying, well, obviously that's not right. Here's what's this, here's what it is, and it gets more extreme. We definitely are seeing it on their part. It's getting more extreme, like you pointed out, that they're pointing out things about wicked people that aren't at all applicable to Job. The idea of forsaking, you know, oppressing, forsaking the poor, and seizing a house, which he's not built, verse 19, you know, description of, yes, in general, as we did, but definitely not Job.
Just as far as a sneak peek goes into the extremity of what it goes to, in Eliphaz's next speech, he says to Job, is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end? You've taken pledges from your brother for no reason, stripped the naked of their clothing, not given the weary water to drink, withheld bread from the hungry. And he just starts listing off straight accusations, things that Job has done. And Job didn't do any of those. And it's just baseless. And it's an attempt to discredit. Like you say, you make the logical arguments, and then when you can't win by saying, well, it's this way, then you try to win by saying, well, you're wrong because you're wicked. You're sinful.
They're short of calling people, calling them names, pretty much.
Yeah, really, they are. Just short of it, yep. You have any other comments or questions through those three chapters? Can't breathe into this microphone, apparently. All right. If not, then that's where we'll close for tonight.